You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The hero of Joshua Ferris's new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, is Paul O'Rourke, a dentist. He's the son of a suicide, a lifelong Red Sox fan, and a man who spends his days shining a light into the dark abyss of people's mouths, trying to stop the inevitable procession of decay and loss. In short, he's a man not unfamiliar with despair. One day, he discovers that someone has set up a website for his business and begun to impersonate him online, proselytizing for an ancient religion. The book is published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased that it brings Joshua Ferris back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Is being a dentist a kind of solitary profession, almost as solitary as being a writer?
I would imagine. I mean, you have that dental assistant nearby, so you've got some company there, and you've got your office manager. These things don't usually come with the writing profession. But yeah, it's a pretty solitary one, I would think.
He opts for a floor plan without a private office because he doesn't want to be any more isolated.
Well, I think his primary concern is to make money. You know? So he gets rid of that private office so he can have a fifth chair, and that brings in some good money. But he doesn't recognize that by doing so, he's got even less privacy in that office. So these women that work with him start to bear down on him, and it just gets worse year after year.
Dentistry is also a profession where your clients often dread and fear you. There's very little good news or happy experience coming to someone in a dentist chair. Even if the dentist is painless, you're always afraid that that noise is just so scary.
Yeah, the noise is no good, and the shining look of those tools is always very foreboding.
Did you, when you were starting to write this, ever, I'm sure one of the things you thought about was what kind of person is attracted to becoming a dentist?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's an odd thing for people to go into it. And some of the dentists that I talked to, I didn't talk to many, but a few of the ones that I talked to seemed to sort of just happen into it. Their passions were elsewhere, and they were very passionate people with hobbies and interests that lay outside of dentistry. But they
because you think they didn't find dentistry completely fulfilling?
Well, some I think just sort of happened into the profession.
And your character here has done that. He's had other jobs before.
He's happened into it, but he's more than anything. I don't even think he remembers a time when he wasn't in other people's mouths. So he's trying to figure out just how to conduct the business of life, and it's a challenge for him.
One of the themes of the novel is the longing for a sense of community and purpose that something like religion offers. But can an atheist find that?
Well, that's his real challenge. I mean, he's committed to reason. He's committed to atheism. And he sees all about him people who are connected in more substantial, namely in religious ways, to a community that he lacks. And I think that sends him off in search of something that he can feel more rooted in.
Is community one of the themes that interests you? Your first book, And Then We Came to the End, is about a group of people working at an ad agency that's about to implode. And you wrote it in the first person plural, which is this community person.
The we. I think it's fair to say, I think probably more nuanced is to say that it's about to what extent can the individual join a community without feeling that he or she has compromised his or her individual will and beliefs. To what extent does groupthink overtake the individual consciousness? Does it overtake subjectivity? And to what extent do you want to hold on to those things that make you an individual by withstanding the allure of the group? But of course, the allure of the group is very strong.
Is there significance in the fact that he decides to put his office on Park Avenue?
Only insofar as there seems to be a whole host of odd customers that come in requesting various things.
But his success also causes him a crisis.
Well, he doesn't have anything beyond that success. I mean, because he's done away with his private office and people come in and pay him gobs and gobs of money to do plastic surgery on their teeth and, or, you know, make his teeth, cosmetic surgery on their teeth and make him look very pretty. He makes a ton of money, and he doesn't know where to go beyond this. I mean, he doesn't know what, once you have these material comforts taken care of, where do you go to find what you're lacking?
Everything else he's tried has fallen short. Golf, banjo, his work, his personal relationships.
Yeah.
What's he looking for, do you think?
Well, at the beginning of the book, you know, he has been pretty isolated by my own devices. He's broken up with his long-term girlfriend, and all of these hobbies have fallen away. And so what he really has more than anything are these clients that come in, these patients that are suffering from rot and decay. And then on the other hand, he has his commitment to atheism. So he really has almost nothing. And so the challenge was to find out what it is that the guy might live for.
And it wasn't streaming TV, which he first thought might be okay. Mm-hmm. He refers to smartphones as me machines. Has all that technological connectedness left him even more alienated?
Well, you know, he says
or
something.
All of us, perhaps?
He says something in the book that's something to the effect of the connected get more connected and the disconnected get more disconnected with the advent of the internet. I think to some extent, the connectivity and the online world is a matter of what you make of it. You know, for a guy like him who is feeling alienated from a good deal of the rest of the world, he's probably going to take the internet and perceive it as another attempt simply to keep him down.
He says, and I'm paraphrasing, everything is something, but nothing is everything. What actually comes across to me is that the one activity he truly believes in, without any doubt, is flossing.
Yeah. Everything is something, but nothing can be everything.
Has flossing become a religious experience for you?
Well, it has that kind of ritualized element that seems to conclude a day. You know, when I'm ready to wrap things up, I floss and then I brush, and that's the real capper. I can get into bed at that point.
Do you own a water pick?
I don't water. I do own one, but I actually don't use it.
That's probably true of a lot of people. Joshua Ferris's latest novel is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's published by Little Brown. His father has committed suicide. He did it when he was 9. Is that what led him to become an atheist?
To some extent, the family life has led him to become an atheist, but I think it's just his embrace of reason. And I think it's also, maybe probably more substantially, it's the fact that he hasn't been born into a strong tradition. He's at a loss to feel rooted to anything, any kind of system of belief, and so he feels at sea, and he doesn't feel like the desire to belong to one of these groups or another is enough. There has to be some belief in God that undergirds that commitment to a larger community, and lacking that belief, he is on the outs for all of them.
At one point, he buys a puppy with his girlfriend, but can't help imagining its aging and death. And one of the reasons he doesn't want to have children is that he thinks having a child would eliminate even the possibility of suicide, and he wants to keep all of his options open.
Yeah, he's a dark dude. I mean, especially at the beginning here, where he's going through his options, he's thinking pretty grimly about the world. And I think it's what this particular dentist has sort of caught as a kind of disease when all of these people come in and they ignore him, they ignore his advice, and they're not really taking care of their mouths. He just sees this kind of death hovering over everything, and he can't kind of get out of the mindset of death.
I guess it makes sense that he would be a Red Sox fan. So was he finally let down when the Sox won a World Series?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Red Sox fans had been out in the wilderness for so long.
He could have been a Cubs fan. Still be out in the wilderness.
Yeah, there's a little play on that toward the end of the book. You know, but the thing that made it so agonizing for the Red Sox is, unlike the Cubs, it was within reach. You know, there were half a dozen times where it might have been possible. The Cubs can never really say that. But, you know, when they did finally win, he sort of wakes up about a year later and says, well, who am I now? I used to know who I was when we were losers, but now that we're winners and we're looking a lot like the Yankees and kind of doing business the Yankee way, who am I?
He hates that their win will now bring the non-devoted fans or believers into the fold.
Yeah. It's very religious for him. You know, I think a lot of people have turned to sports and made it a great religious escape. And for him, it is certainly a preoccupation on religious levels. I mean, he's recorded every statistic in every game, and he knows everything about it. And once the those people who he does not believe to be worthy of the Red Sox mantle take it up, he's a little bothered.
Although he's an atheist, this is a book about religion on a lot of levels. One day he finds a website for his practice on the internet, and he manages to trace it back to a patient, a disgruntled patient?
Just somebody who thinks he belongs to this ancient religion.
There's a Twitter account that starts proselytizing an ancient religion, the Ohms.
Yeah.
You made that up.
I made it up.
And you had to not only invent the religion and its set of beliefs, but also you have quoted passages that sound kind of, but not quite, as if they come from the Bible.
That's right. I went back to the Bible and kind of got the cadence down and just sort of ripped it off here and there, and you know, tailored it to my purposes. It was a lot of fun. It was a real pain in the butt because you have to figure out, well, how is this theological sounding stuff going to work in the novel? You've really got to kind of use two different hats there and make sure that they blend nicely.
What is the heart of the Ohm Creed?
It's a contradiction. It says basically, if you doubt God, then you are a believer. So God comes down and says to the first Ohm, your duty is to doubt me. And he, of course, says, well, when you're standing there before me, it's a little hard to do that. Later, Ohms can then sort of get around that by saying, well, we're not really sure if he had just a mystical experience or if he was crazy or whatever. And so they can kind of, you know, cheat a little bit.
At one point, Paul stops trying to prosecute the former patient and actually becomes interested in the tweets. Mm-hmm. So he likes this other version of himself to some degree.
Yeah, he also starts a private email exchange with him, and this person seems to have figured it out in a way that he certainly has not. You know, as you spoke about at the onset of the book, that there's not a whole lot he's living for. And this guy that speaks to him through tweets and through Facebook and through emails seems to have a whole rich life, and he'd like to get some of that.
Paul envies the spiritual lives of his girlfriends, particularly his Jewish girlfriend, Connie.
Yeah.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I know that writers, novelists, hate it when people ask about the autobiographical aspects of a novel. I'm assuming that none of this is autobiographical, but where is Joshua Ferris in all of this?
Well, certainly looking in from the outside at strong religious and cultural groups, I felt a good deal of envy. I mean, I was similar. I have a biographical background, much like Paul. I didn't have a strong foundational community, a religious community that I grew up in. And going
you
to
felt
college,
a vacuum there?
Yeah, for sure. And also an inability really to embrace belief. So, you know, when I was looking in at these groups from the outside, I did long to be a part of them. And I wanted to share that with this guy who then finds a kind of counter-historical entity called the Ohms who can sort of rescue him from what somebody in the book describes the hell on earth that is being passed over religiously while we live.
Have you come to believe I doubt, therefore I am?
I haven't embraced the scripture because I am far too aware of its fictionality.
Joshua Ferris is the author of two previous novels, Then We Came to the End and The Unnamed. His fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, Tin House, Best American Short Stories. He was chosen for The New Yorker's 20 Under 40 list of fiction writers in 2010. His latest book, I should ask you, perhaps, to explain the title, is To Rise Again at a Decent Hour.
It just sort of sounds nicely biblical, you know? I mean, the book does a whole lot of sort of pseudo-biblical writing, and so there's a cast of Bible to that.
Because dentists don't have to show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, do they?
Well, if you're driven like this fella, you do. But no, you can make your hours.
The book is published by Little Brown. Joshua Ferris, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.